the non-existing home products used in the building material must be pest-proof products. So then you don't have a situation where the product goes into the building of office, and we find that towards October last year, and we've already had encouraging results because the NHBRC is now insisting that most of the materials, if not all, goes into the buildings covered by the London. And industry has already been informed as early as 2003. This thing was published in 2005 and it will become enforceable from 1st of January 2008. We'll get ourselves to respond to that one. In terms of also running design, we believe that this country's future lies to a great extent in the success that we can register in innovation, coming up with doing things differently. And that's how a lot of these emerging economies like Korea and so on have evolved, to start investing seriously in their design capabilities. Now we run three design teams in the Design Institute. The one is the Design Excellence Award, and we also run the Youth Designer Award on June 16th, and then we also have towards November the Prototype Award. Now what was significant that right here from the Cape Flats, and you'll see the photo in our annual report, youngsters here from Mitchell's Place, who are electrical technical students here at UCT, last year won our Design Excellence Award for their induction casting machine for platinum jewelry, something equivalent of about 2 or 3 microwave ovens, but they designed something that can actually melt those platinum slugs and with minimum effort simulate very informal jewelry activities there. And it took them about something the better part of 4.5 years to design it, but they're pumping in a lot of money now. Just on their first, after the thing was introduced, they sold 28 units the next day to Amtrak. And this is part of the work we're doing, encouraging design. We've also held design development in Kota at the Innovation Hub in Pretoria, and we were glad to host some of our excellent counterparts in Botswana, Kenya, Nigeria, and Uganda. And they actually came with exhibitions of some of their products designed on the African continent. It was quite an enriching experience for the rest of us to see how people also apply their minds to address some very basic developmental issues in their own environment through appropriate design. We have published a bi-monthly newsletter to the network of African designers, and this is now promote greater contact among members of the design community on the African continent. As far as the results are concerned, we've increased our revenue by 15% compared to the previous financial year. Our total expenditure also increased because we had to recapitalize our business substantially so that we can position the business to respond from a technological perspective to what the market takes out there. And operating profit has increased before taxation and financing to the tune of 42.9 million rand. And there was a bit of a restatement in the account in which it became a method that was reported because we were waiting for the actuarial results from the actuary to look at the long service leave liability after taxation, and the actuary only provided us with the report after the statement already with the Auditor General, and that had to be restated because that exposure amounts to about 17 million. Our capital expenditure totaled 37.2 million compared to a budget of 30.6 last year, and we've again got an unqualified audit opinion this year. And this is just a snapshot on what the financials look like, and members can see there were increases on what we've actually budgeted, what they budgeted, and what the actual numbers have been in comparison with year-to-date March 2006, year-to-date March 2007. This is just an indication of how there have been changes in our revenue cycle, and you can see over the last 3 years consistently we moved our revenue up from 5.5% in 2005, 9.2% increase in 2006, and this year 15% in 2007. As to whether it can be sustained, anybody guess, because with the exit of regulatory next year, the levy income flows will drop, but we're working hard to maintain these levels of sustainability. And this is just a comparison on our revenue over the 2 years, the green block indicating 2006 and the blue block 2007. And you can see in all sectors, investigation, testing services, levy, certification, as well as sales and publication, there were increases in our revenue. These are our top three expenses. Staff costs remain a very, very high expenditure item because, as I hinted earlier on, human capital is it's a very capital intensive environment, and we competing also with major players in the industry to retain technological skills and scientific skills, as well as our investment in human capital development will for a while still remain a big ticket item. The other one is travel, because a lot of our audit work happens on site, inspection work happens on site, as well as some of our contract services we need to sometimes rope in to augment some of our internal capabilities. We have just isolated three DPI objectives against which we've measured ourselves. And the first one is promoting broader participation, equity, and redress in the economy. And in response to that objective, we've supported regional, national and regional imperatives through the following issues. We've trained 82 SMEs in clothing, textile, civil, and brick-making fields to make sure that they are compliant with some of the procurement requirements, not only in government, but also in the private sector, and their quality capabilities greatly enhanced. We've also supported 50 SMEs to our subsidy scheme to test their products. Currently, the ratio is between 50% and 25% that we will be resisting, depending on the capacity of SME, but we want to make sure that we increase market access also of our SMEs. To date, we've harmonized 63 study standards. Now, honorable members are aware that we're heading for a free trade area in 2011, and standards are going to become very critical in making sure that the flow of goods and services between various countries in SADC. If you don't have non-tariff barriers to the flow of goods and services, and fairness is going to become a very critical factor there. But there's been a bit of a slump in the output of standard harmonization in SADC. When the expert group met in Madagascar this year, the output was lower than the previous year in Namibia when we met. Because one thing to write a standard is another thing to create the capability to implement the standard. And I've seen capacity variances in SADC regions, and a lot of focus also went into capacity over and above the harmonization of standards. And to that end, we provided training to standards institutes in Botswana and Lesotho, and more recently Swaziland, as well as Namibia. The second objective that the DTI set for ourselves is promoting broader participation, equity, and redress in the economy. And 50% of all our procurement spend were from the suppliers last year, and a large percentage of it on SMEs. As far as employment equity is concerned, in the professional category, 47% are black professionals, and 68% of our staff complement are from previously disadvantaged, from the designated group, of which females are 41%. To us, it's still a big challenge because the throughput in our total system for technical and scientific expertise is so limited. It's been a very male-dominated environment, but quite encouraging to see a lot of our females entering this field now, and we set ourselves a target which is realistic, and I think we're well on target at this point in time because it stands at 41%. The third objective we set for ourselves was promoting coordinated implementation of the Accelerated and Shared Growth Initiative. And here, we first wanted to look internal and make sure that there's sustainability in our operations. Because we only get about 80% of our money from government, the rest we generate through our own efforts, through our commercial activities. And therefore, this year, in order to sustain ourselves, we have generated 12% more commercial revenue. Our publication team, the standard sales, there was a tremendous uptake, and I think some of the favorites revolve around the business, the building codes, the electrical codes, and so on, because of the major infrastructure spending taking place in the country. And we've almost doubled our sales in standard sales last year, not only national standards here, but also some of the international standards, ISO and IEC, which we perform on an agency basis. As I already reported, we've reduced our standards from 185 to 177, and the cost has been greatly reduced. We've also increased market access for export of goods by 1,258 new and revised standards produced, so that South African companies can have the capability to access markets much more easily. 100% inspection and testing of local imports and exports of all fishery products. And we're a full member of the International Standards Organization. As a matter of fact, last year we were elected for a 2-year term onto the ISO Council. And one of our executives also served on the ISO Technical Management Board. We're also a member of the International Electrical Commission of the Pacific Area Standards Congress because of our close trade links to the Pacific Area. With the Organization of International Metrology. One of our members is currently the Vice President of that institution. We're also holding the Secretariat of FedEx STAN as well as FedEx Metrology. And the whole notion of market relevance and recognition is also very important to us. And all we can report is all our commercial accreditation and certification operations have retained their accreditation. None of our labs were disqualified. As a matter of fact, the error fallout rate 3 years ago was 123. We've narrowed it down to 25. And last year, during our accreditation, it came down to 21. Still not good enough, but we're getting there. Another area of skills development is DTI set for us, and technology infrastructure platform. Human capital development, I need to reemphasize again, a great issue to us. And we need provide internships to 35 university graduates and technical students and experiential training working staff. We offered 11 training permanent employment after their successful training, 11 out of the 35. We provided 180 bursaries, and that includes the capacity building of some of our managers. Some of them are even studying towards MBA qualification. But all is not like in any organization. With the successes also comes the challenge. And in our understanding, there are a few challenges which we need to aggressively pursue. And one is broaden our stakeholder base and secure and maintain interest and fairness development. God's high standards and developed standards in the Vatican, we must maintain the interest of our stakeholder base in standards development. Otherwise, it becomes a grudging compliance, and people will just go through the motion. They need to appreciate the value of standardization, and that can only be done if we broaden our stakeholder base and secure and maintain the interest. But we also need to expand services in important markets to support the new industrial policy. A few months ago, the industrial policy was launched with great applause in the public eye, and we have already positioned ourselves to support some of those key industries outlined in the industrial policy and make sure that there is sufficient support to drive that process from a standardization perspective. There is capacity variances in SADC, and this capacity variances will actually work against successful regional integration. And we have made internal efforts in our own humble way to address some of those capacity variances and try and support some of our counterparts in SADC. But one also needs to do it with a great deal of sensitivity, because South Africa doesn't want to be perceived as Big Brother, where we know it all and we kind of stifle sometimes even some of the very valuable, innovative contributions that people from the continent, from SADC, can make. Perhaps for all other businesses, the name of this is the information age. And therefore, we have invested heavily, close to 31 million rand, in our IT infrastructure to make sure that it's adequate and reliable. So before we started on this process, we discovered that we were 35% paper-based, and you can't run an international best practice organization if 35% of your people are pushing paper around. And the major effort is to of our business process engineering is through the better utilization of IT tools, we can enhance our output. Our building is quite old. We've well maintained it, but some of the aging technical infrastructure is starting to show. And we've made a bid to our shareholder to reinvest in infrastructure, because some of these things are so sensitive to the infrastructure collapse. There's a whole cycle of activities that can totally collapse. The whole notion of scarce skills, we're equally affected by that. The moment you train people up to a certain level, industry is very keen. Recently, they even bought out some of our bursary recipients. Say, okay, what's your bursary obligation? Sign a check and they grab. These are some of the dynamics that we continually have to grapple with. How do we compete in an environment where the supply and demand ratios are not that equal? There's also the whole question of physical security. Given the high level of trust and integrity that we need to have in our equipment and so on, to make sure that the environment is safe and secure. We had a few unsavory incidences where one of our sites at NETFA, people just come and shoot, you know, and just break in, do all manner of funny things there, and that is becoming a serious challenge for us. And obviously, the successful exit of the regulatory division. As earlier alluded, towards the first quarter of next year, the envisaged exit. We want to make sure that there is a smooth transition, that there is no backing between this movement of regulatory from SENA, and that regulatory will still be in a position to perform its mandate. Jefferson, we want to say that we've indeed had a successful year, but the challenges remain, and we committed to the task to make sure that we're looking out for you as Lord of South African society, to be the guardian of society, and to pursue our work highly conscientious, because we believe that Sam is about quality of conscience. And this thought wants to assure the committee today, we will definitely embrace the necessary commitment as required from our shareholder. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, CEO of the appropriate Europe Standard. Thanks that you are still with us, because some of us are beginning to worry over the past few weeks when we read on the papers that you were out in some international conference invited by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan. Said that you are actually hitting a very huge part. He just said, hey, he's now gone. We're going to drive this big institution in our country. So thank you very much, and the work that you have done there is quite important. I'm glad to thank you together with the team. Having done so, then we thank you to the members for your questions and input. I think that the Major, Chen, Prof. Churok, Kovic, and Jigalana, Yastadiman.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have a number of questions. There are not more than five or either four. We usually see many dumping places in townships and rural areas where used chemicals are dumped all over in the open place in the community. And those chemicals are of a danger to the community. And again, there is many unroadworthy vehicles in a taxi in Hassan. And these taxis are transporting the commuters. And I just want to know if institution is able to manage the health and the safety within the taxi and the industry, and also in these townships and rural areas where dumping has been done. And if you are able to do so, because there are still, lots of things which can cause a serious health to the people. What are you doing at the moment to control the inspection or either the functioning to normalize the situation and the condition? And the other one, you'll excuse me, and the other one, there are firms and industries, manufacturing firms and industries, which in their process of manufacturing are still polluting the air. And in your institution, do you deal with the supervision and the inspection functions and the implementation of regulations combating air pollution? If so, what are you doing at this moment? Then the last one, I've seen in your book page 40, monitoring of radiation exposure of health. How do you handle the cell phone radiation to the people of this country? Thank you.
Yes, Adamaja, the next
thanks, yes. You see, that is all those the new system of policy we put into place. And we don't know whether it's going to work or not until we're starting to do it. I want to ask the number one person, SABS, do you have any feedback system or channel to open to the people who have been using, you know, all these systems, and if they have any difficulty, to give you some feedback, you know, to give you information to see how we can improve the system. The reason I'm saying that, you know, no law or no system is 100%. It is perfect. We all know it. But you know, when we're doing it, you sure have to set up one backup to let people, you know, to all, you know, they have backup, even the people working in your government, to put the difficulty they find. And so you can see, you know, you can look at every 3 months or 6 months and see if anything you can do to correct it. That is my suggestion, and I want you to look at it. And the other one is, I cannot say that this is a question, but I decided myself to raise this question to all these departments I'm going to attend to is, we're talking about the there's no delivery. Right, the delivery is not there. You know, this passing 1 month, I just, you know, the accident found it out. A lot of our government senior manager was under contract 3 to 5 years. So I'm not so sure in your the organization is also a lot of your senior manager 3 to 5 years. Because, you know, if you have anybody you hire for 3 year contract, he's not going to deliver. I mean, I'm a new member of parliament. Even today, I'm struggling to find, you know, where the good I am. It takes some time for me to learn. So if you hire anybody, no matter how good he or she is, he needs at least 1 year to find his or her good. Right? The second year, maybe they start to understand the word. The third year, he is going to punish. I mean, not punish, he's going to panic. Because he doesn't know where is their future. So I'm not so sure, you know, because you are talking about you have lots of training here, right? You're talking about those training people, you know, they get, you know, some of this, the permanent employee job. I don't believe that is in your organization, maybe outside. But I think that is one of the no delivery all our department. Even in your department, you must think deeply about, you know, those contacts. And it is very senior position, I couldn't understand. You know, and I think that is, even if it's not ready to this question here, but I want to go back and see. Even 5 years, I don't think so. Even you go to contract to 3 or 5 years, then you must think about 5 years, that is when you're in contract 5 years. And then, before, if you think that they are good, I think that 1.5 years before, you're starting to start negotiating. But I found out that a lot of them, even the last 3 months, they don't know where the future. So where the delivery is going to be? I mean, so everybody looking on their futures, right? So, and also, I don't want to make any decision. If I know I'm going to finish 1 year, and this is what I found out, that a lot of media happened like this one. You know? And if you are a leader, you are a manager, if I am a CEO, I have a manager working for me, I rely on him to do some case study, to come back to me. But because he is going to retire or he's going to finish his contract with 1 year, you think he's going to do the job to take the responsibility for me? He's not going to do. He's not going to make any decision. He will keep on just pass on. So, you know, I just, this one, I'm going to write it for all those departments if I get a chance to let them know. And, you know, I want you to also look at things. Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to follow on the comments by the Honourable Mafia here. And my comment is probably very unfair, and you may not find it easy to answer what I'm going to say. It's unfair because I've just spent a week in the Transkei, in the deep Transkei, and really there are no standards there on almost anything. The vehicles, the roads, the dirt, the services, things are pretty awful in the area that I was in. Admittedly, one restricted area, I'm not going to name it. Normally when we talk about standards, we're talking about the formal economy and the cities and the production of manufacturing and so on. This is what we normally understand by standards. But in your brief, it seems to go somewhat beyond that. And the question is, and I think it's probably very unfair, is it possible for your organization to play a role in the deep rural areas so that people down there also have a sense that there are national standards that they have to observe? Now, the answer obviously is that local authorities do the job. But you, in a way, override government and local authority. Is it unfair to say that the people, the millions of people in the deep rural areas, also have a right to look to your organization for some relief against the appalling lack of standards in public domain? Is it unfair?
Thank you, Chair. Mine is around the SADC. But the first comment is just to comment and express appreciation that the Bureau of Standards is in line with the regional economic integration. It's going to be very helpful. As people who are also keen, or personally very keen to ensure that there's regional economic integration, but that obviously concomitant to that is the standardization program. But a serious question is that what contribution are SADC members doing? One can pick up from the report that also the training done in various SADC countries. The second question for you, Chair, is mentioned made that there's a need for major, not just ordinary, but major refreshments in terms of aging technical infrastructure. Are there any estimates? That's my question. The last one is the reference made to an exit of the regulatory division. What are the exact details or implications? Please say how I know I was late. If it was mentioned before, well, I'll have to look for it elsewhere. It's just a matter of curiosity. Thanks.
Thank you,
Commissioner.
Thank you,
Chair. My question relates to the chemical industry. Before I start, it said that the South African diesel fuel, South Africa, is carried still after the new stipulations that were enforced by government, is still very much higher than the European common market component. So now I see that Mr. Kusser, you said that you have implemented revised standards for unleaded petrol and automotive diesel fuel. And you say that it's on par with 3 and 4 of the European common market and something like that. Is it still substantially higher as far as pollution is concerned than the accepted European standard? And how long will it take
sake for us to be involved with those things, because from what I gather is that our degree of pollution, especially sulfur, is of the highest in the developing world, in some parts of South Africa, especially when it comes to the generation of electricity and so forth. So I'd just like to know whether you have set a benchmark when you will be on par with the European Common Mark or other developing countries. Thank you, Chair.
Last question will come from me.
Sorry.
Yeah, on the GI objective, it seems to me that the city of the institution just have that thing. By the way, the EEE, one of the objectives of the GTI, what are we doing? And he or she saw fit to just write one sentence on page 42. Just one sentence, so that it must say that the FADL is also participating in this. Is it the EEE or is it not based like economy and power? Can you expand on that? Give us a clarity on the SMMEs as well on page 31, the Akula certification and the workshop. Where would you convene this workshop? In what places? Which province? And how many of the SMMEs have been awarded the certificate? Are there SMMEs that will be from rural areas? The other one would be around the question that was asked by Professor again, which relates to rural sky. But in a nutshell, is there any working relationship with the different years of government, provinces, joining districts, and local municipalities? So that this web would actually be an end level where people are. The last question, and many questions, but I want to end this one. In all the program on HIV/AIDS, I see you are doing much on that, but there was a control around condoms that just by us and the parachutes. Masses of our people. Can you talk to the change, actually clarify whether those that might pass the system would have been coached? And I understand it's not only one company that actually tried to, there are many other companies that have been actually flouting the rules and procedures.
No, thank you, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. I think a lot of these questions are quite thought-provoking, and some of them I need to put within the context of our mandate. I know Professor Professor Tewoli and Professor Turok will really be unfair. So let's just appropriate it within our mandate, and then we will judge whether it will be unfair or not. The two questions that you raised around our role in issues like chemical pollution, as well as the role that we're protecting, what is our role, what is our level of involvement. Now, in as far as enforcing environmental legislation is concerned, as well as the transportation of dangerous substances, the enforcement side lies with other government agencies, notably the Department of Environmental Affairs, as well as the Department of Transport when it comes to the transportation of dangerous goods and services. We basically wrote up the standard to say if you transport goods, these are the minimum standards to which these goods need to comply with. If you transport chemicals, these are how the container should be labeled, how it should be kept, and so on. But the actual operational oversight lies with the Department of Health. We don't have enforcement capability. Our inspection sphere does not enter that area. Only on sold goods, but not on the aftercare, you know, when people dump stuff and so on. You can only move in and say, this chemical does not need the following inspected chemical. Make it aware, you can't trade it and so on. But once it finds its way in the environment and so on, that's the problem. The same with down the road with Texas. We do it on an agency basis on behalf of the Department of Transport. There's a process called homologation, which means we need to make sure that this vehicle meets all the safety critical requirements, rollover protection, brakes, the lighting system, seat belt, those sort of things. And that's the terrain which we operate in to test whether it complies. But as to whether these things are roadworthy once they've been tested and they started operating out there, it becomes a law enforcement responsibility of the Department of Transport, Cruise Agency, in the Road Transportation Act. The only recourse that the public can have to us is once the product has been approved and there are defects out there, then the public can question how come that, you know, after only a limited amount of usage, this thing has gone through, and we can then ask for a review process. But there are clear provisions what needs to be tested in order for that vehicle to be parked. We got involved by default, for example, on the motor vehicle testing station. And then there was a whole host of arguments about the whole conflict here because it's a major money spender in the provincial transport department. And we moved out of that arena because there's now National Transportation Agency being set up to deal with all those things. And our accreditation role, that's where it is. We credit these things, but how it operates after that becomes a law enforcement situation. The cell phone radiation, what is quite interesting is, as I'm talking to you now, the place called Kopanong there in Benoni, we've got top 12 of the world's top experts. We actually sponsored a PhD doctorate through collaboration with the medical faculty at Victoria University. There was some collaboration with Stellenbosch, Swane University of Technology, to look at this question. I'm a little bit hesitant to preempt the outcome, but all I can say, yesterday's papers I've listened to, there are some issues at stake here on cell phone radiation. That's what the research has now shown. As to the degree of risk to the broader population, that's part of the deliberation. We're having a major standards convention on the 11th, and we're keenly awaiting the outcome of that deliberation. And we'll keep, I'd like to have your contact details so that we can pass on that information on the write-up of the conference paper there. But radiation, yes, we write the standards, and we've done research now to improve on that standard. We've done the research now to find out is there a serious risk to play. And coincidentally, as I'm talking now, this conference is happening in the north.
Perhaps I can add to that, because I think the question not only went around cell phone radiation, the question was not only around cell phone radiation, but around radiation hazards to radiation work. If that was the case, just to mention that we provide a service, the radiation protection service, for all registered radiation workers. That's X-ray, people who carry out X-rays, who work in that type of industry, who work in the sort of nuclear industry. And on behalf of the authorities, all of those people carry a badge, and we actually carry out the service of analyzing the dosage received by those people. So it's a service provided to the regulator who's responsible for regulating the amount of exposure to radiation. That's a really good description of the service we offer.
The feedback mechanism, we have appointed a group called Consulta. They have done external work to talk to all our clients on how they experience our service. And that greatly informed our best service. In my initial input, I made members aware, you know, they liked that, but they didn't like our service at all. And our business process engineering was informed by the stakeholder perception survey. We also have internal feedback mechanisms to make sure that we have sector boards. There's a mining sector board, currently operational, there's a compensation sector board, there's an electrotechnical sector board, there's also consumer sector board, where all the major stakeholders meet quarterly with us to give us feedback on participation. They also greatly assist us to anticipate what's going to happen in their industry so that we can position ourselves for any new development within that industry. We're still working with some of the other ones like food and health, you know, given the diverse. And then we target government as a sector. All the major client departments, we visit them regularly, like mineral and energy. Thank you, Honorable Sura. Like mineral and energy and health and so on, to make sure that there's a dynamic interaction so that we don't operate in a vacuum, that we continue to. But all our executives, standing item on all, we have one business review expo meeting per month. And it's a standing item on that business review, all clients visit, wherever I went, wherever some of my executives and their managers, what's the responses we get from all our clients so that we can timely respond to those things. We just had a strategy session a couple of weeks ago on the very vexing question you asked about 3 to 5. We're preparing a paper to our council. In law as well, you can be challenged on this 3 to 5 year. There has been a precedent set here on this 3 to 5 year contract time horizon. Currently, all our senior managers from level 5 to level 1 is on this short-term 3-year contracts with an option to renew it. But we've seen it many times in the past that this element of uncertainty limits people's ability to look beyond their current time horizon. But if the contract is properly structured and there's a proper performance management system in place, if people don't perform, you can initiate remedial action, and out of that process, you also have a mutual agreement that there can be a notice period of 3 months, 30 days, whatever they agree upon. And you don't sit with this uncertainty. People want to plan their careers in advance. They can easily then just use that as a training ground and move on if there are no future career aspects. And I share your sentiment that this is an inhibiting factor, and we're working towards that. I'm happy for now to have a 5-year contract, but you know, beyond that, there might be other levels of management we want to succeed, and if there's no certainty, we can create problems. And we trust that we can convince our council to go beyond the current status quo. This issue of deep rural areas involvement. Honorable Tura, standards is about quality of life issues. The very water you drink is informed by standard process. The car that you came to work with is informed. The light you shine this year. The whole range of activities is informed. So it's about quality of life. And we've not been as good as would have wanted to be, to have that message right up to grassroots level. But a lot of these things hinges on partnerships. And we successfully established a consumer sector board where we touch now
all the provincial economic affairs consumer desks are part of it. The National Consumer Forum of Tami Bolai and them, and the one of Ina Birken was it called Sangu, South Africa National Consumer Union. As a matter of fact, we provide them with premises on our site so that they can participate in the standardization process. We publish articles on their newspapers. We use their website. And it's only through partnership that we can deal with these things. But we also have a very beautiful example. The first municipality in South Africa to subject itself to a quality management system. Gesu. It's a municipality called Makana in the very Eastern Cape, the old Grahamstown. They are ISO 9035. They subjected themselves to the highest scrutiny of international management. And we've awarded them their certificate. Seven of their departments, including treasury, emergency services, all those things, meet all those standards. We worked with the Department of Provincial and Local Government towards the process. Dr. Johnson was intimately involved with one of the DDGs there, and that process just fell flat, not because of lack from outside. Now we're targeting individual municipalities, and we've got three others in the pipeline that's due for certification very soon, one in Richards Bay and a couple of others. But once quality is appreciated at leadership level, it becomes a culture, the way we deal with the community out there. And that will be our son in capacitating the leadership and making embedded in the whole service delivery value chain there. And by so doing, people will experience it differently. There are other partnerships that we also have with other agencies, but I think this is not going to be a staff effort, it's going to be a collaborative effort from all stakeholders, so that the whole quality of life issue is also experienced. We have now repositioned the staff brand, and unfortunately I can't guarantee the quality of this fruit juice here, because it doesn't have the same mark on. Neither can I require a receiving to bring this water in. But the mark now will have, there will be three issues that will inform the mark. One, it's about quality. Second, it will be fit for purpose, which means that product met all the specifications which the standard dictates. And thirdly, it will be about recourse. Once the mark is on our product, the consumer can come back to us and say, when I slept on that silicone chapeadic last night, I woke up with a backache for weeks now, and see the problem that was your SABS mark, the best design, and so on. And we already had a couple of big egos that have been, marks that have been removed from very, very branded firms, especially in the electrotechnical industry. Some of the products revered by women in this audience, in their planning, we took the mark away because they didn't meet the quality criteria. And by so doing, there's a greater public education that needs to go into this process so that the public exercise better choice and insist on quality. We've got a very weak consumer culture in this country, and sooner than answer, the better. Although, as I said in my input, there are some capacity variances there. We harmonized 68 standards last year, a lot of them around the transportation sector and so on. But at the risk of sounding a little bit harsh, but you know, certain standards division, standards bodies inside it, it's a subdirectorate within the economic affairs department of that specific government. Namibia just a month ago passed a bill, and a month ago they set up the institutional arrangement in place to have their own standards point. Swaziland has just recently, appointed the CEO about a month ago. And so I can take you through a whole range of issues. And we try our best to train, to equip, to make sure that they come over for placement, work with our people,
so that we can enhance the capacity issue. But we must also appreciate these are sovereign countries, and their choices are not necessarily our choices. And we try to influence the highest political office. We've been in impact here. With our Secretary General, I just spoke at the ministerial meeting of trade and industry ministers in Egypt recently. And these are ongoing processes to make sure right to the top is buying for the whole standardization process. Because if we don't do that, export and free trade will not take place within Saudi. The exit of the triple answer on the refurbishment cost, but as far as the exit of regulatory is concerned, the SQAM review was published in 2001. It was hotly debated in NEDLAC, and there is now consensus that in order to bring some African quality infrastructure, international best practice, we must separate the regulatory division from that. Because all these three units actually operate, we've got the standard development unit that writes the standard and say this is how things should be done. You have a conformity assessment unit, the commercial unit where testing and certification takes place. They create the capabilities for you to comply with the standards by testing, certification, and so on. And you've got the regulatory division that actually police whether these things have been implemented or not. Now, by having all three in one site, we are accused of being referee and player at the same time. And therefore, the regulatory division, especially when it comes to compulsory respect, need to be a standalone facility, unfettered from any influences. Not that we've influenced them up till now, don't get me wrong. It is just a good practice to have them separated. The implications, we've been working through it very, very closely with the Department of Trade and Industry, Public Service, and Administration, as well as Treasury, to make sure that there's a smooth transition. I'm sure by next week, the 17th, there will be a briefing to the committee around the bill and its implications, and I would like to preempt the discussion. Honorable Rabi, this thing of pollution. South Africa's calm population by European standards is a relatively small population. And therefore, one is also very careful to strike that balance between public interest and economic reality. And that's why we argue for a phase-in process. Instead of going Euro 4 immediately, we staggered it from Euro 2 to Euro 3 come next year. Because it takes a lot of investment to retool the equipment that goes in cars. And the question arises, is there such high levels of pollution if we go to Euro 3? The question that we arrived at is that by going Euro 3 and step up later on in the population, car population increase to Euro 4, that is a much more orderly transition than enforcing it, and yet it will increase the cost of producing cars here. So that balance has always been considered, and the sulfur level is very high. Yes, the standard has been rewritten in such a way to address some of these concerns. And we also have the same capabilities now in planning to deal with these emissions, because a lot of diamond Chrysler, BMW, and so on, there's a lot of export going into Europe. And we need to make sure that we comply with the rate. Cliff, if you can deal with the refurbishment.
The refurbishment issue is that the buildings at the moment, they were built, I'm talking about the head office. The first major building went up in 1970 and the second one was occupied in 1974. They've been maintained over the years, but over that 30 plus years life, the basic infrastructure has now reached the end of its design life. This is a very fundamental stuff of water reticulation, all the things that you need to provide services for that. So that's part of the integral structure. Structure itself is sound. We face a major refurbishment which will take place over a number of years. The first phase, which will simply rescue the very critical laboratories that are required to run on a 24-hour basis, and if there's any break in the services, there are major implications to the industry. That first phase, the estimated cost is some 250 million rand. And we have a request up to Treasury at the moment to fund that. We need that money quite urgently. The remainder of the refurbishment, we are pursuing the concept that we haven't decided to find it yet, of developing the remainder of the site that we have, which has quite a lot of vacant land, in a PPP project, which would release sufficient funds to carry out the remainder of the refurbishment and to hand over then the risk of maintaining that structure to the private sector. So phase one, 250 million. Phase two, probably more than that, but in consultation with the private sector through a PPP project.
The DPR objectives, you said we just squeezed in one line there. It's about our spend. The BD spend, the target that was set for us was 45%, and we've reached 54% on BD for the purchases. It's a critical indicator which DPR sets for all its agencies, and hence we put it down here as a critical indicator on how we broaden access, especially for the company. We've rated ourselves recently, by the way, we are level 5 institution in terms of the triple BEE scorecard. I always get confused about this. We're a level 5 institution, and we also rate our suppliers accordingly. As far as the SMMT support, where are we doing and when? So I don't have an elaborate list here, but we normally do it in conjunction with other government agencies like CEDA, and we also had our own enterprise development unit, where we target institutions. You take, for example, in Eastern Cape, we prepared people literally there with SMMTs in the pineapple industry to manufacture sorghum for export to Europe. Now these are SMMT people. And Europe is very stringent on this. And all these other procurement processes, government for uniforms, for the military and so on, for construction and so on. We can provide you with an elaborate list, we haven't included it here. But it's not urban bias, it's spread throughout the country. The working relationship with different spheres of government, I hinted earlier on our involvement with local government, but it can improve. It is just that our mandate restricts us to certain things. And finding that level of collaboration with other departments, one always needs to strike a fine balance. Less reduce and coach. In a lot of cases, we're acting as an agent for them. In other areas, it is our main concern. Now, at long last, the condom question arose. I was actually getting nervous nobody asked this question. We had this very unfortunate incident that, notwithstanding the fact that on a daily basis, we generate a few hundreds test reports in our 72 laboratories just at Fruit Group alone. And we've got 19 sites throughout the country. As a matter of fact, our biggest clients being Richards Bay Coal Terminal, we generate hundreds of test reports because there's a minimum of 1 to 2 ships, 365 days per year for coal export out of Richards Bay. Around the corner here in Saldanha, 24-hour shift every day, 365 days, not a single incident. And here came this strange email from Mr. Weston, where the reporter wrote to me, said, listen here,
can you respond to the following? Accurate detail. I don't tell the reporter, listen here, unless I know the name of the individual, because there are 11 test officers and one manager, I might be going for the wrong people. The ultimate they have an agreement that he gives me the name, they will break the story to them first. And I'll generally write straight off. And there was caught. We confronted the manager, we suspended him, we looked at a few test reports, and we found out that the test reports had been tampered with of this specific company. Within 24 hours, we recalled that manager, charged him, and then he made a confession in writing. And by the way, on Mr. Chambers, what was just said, he's a highly skilled individual, big qualifications, he was in Notice Month, he worked for one of the top multinationals in South Africa, in that Notice Month, 2 weeks before we're supposed to be getting caught up with him. We groomed him for 2.5 years to take on the senior management position. And he put the whole nation at risk for the sake of a few samosas and 4.5 thousand. Now, it's 1,000 years, 1,005 years, 2,000 days. The whole nation was put at risk. We immediately then reported this matter to the Department of Health, to the commercial branch. This individual was arrested. As a matter of fact, he'll be appearing in court tomorrow on the 10th of October. He's the person that brought the money to him, was also arrested, and the MD of that company, Mr. Howard, gave himself over, and they were all afraid for tomorrow. We then did a follow-up on our system, and we realized that because he was the manager, he had to finally sign off to identify the weakness now. No one person signs off anymore. It must be two people signing off on a test report, and we were also okay who the second person might be. So you don't know who you should infiltrate. So to ultimately, you know, pass on a couple of commissions and whatever, as a branch. But this was reported to the Commercial Crime Unit, reported to the Department of Health, and there was a full recall of all the choice condoms, which is the Department of Health brand, especially that which is in this company, called LSP. We then asked LSP to recall all their products because they bear our mark. They recall all their products and we send out our auditors to go and inspect all the labs, all the sites. Bronco Spray, Durban, Cape Town, everything. And to look at their production processes, their drone samples, we're going through a second round of testing. But whatever was out there by LSP has been quarantined. And we're now busy with follow-up sampling and we continue discussion with the Department of Health. Up till now, nothing has come to our attention that warrants any other issues, but for now, the sampling is vigorously being pursued. Systems have been tightened up, and the whole staff has been put on the list. It's a very unfortunate incident. It's one of just those things which, with your best intentions in the world, if there's human error at play here, people can make such choices at the risk of the nation. There's just one way to deal with charges.
Madam Officer, at this note, we are going to Jan, and we are going to have the next presentation from the FDR. But before that, we are going to take a break for tea. 5 minutes tea, then we reconvene. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Last year, based on the calling of the
condoms,
so recall all of them.
Yeah, they recall the moment
the production of the
all of them.
Okay. And because of the message of the Department of Health. Yes. Can you put me some juice on the way back? Energy.
Something. I just.
Oh, okay. That's long.
Counseling, which I'm sure is going to come up somehow.
and then Ms. Mochikari is the chief operating officer of the NCR. I mean, so she's the one that's responsible to keep the troops in line. So she'll talk through particularly registrations. But I'll do the presentation first, then in the question time, discussion time, there will be more participants. What we've done in the presentation is the, I mean, given that the annual report is at 31st of March, we focused in the presentation on 31st of March.
Assuming being fair, can we think of that my way?
In the presentation, we focused on the annual report as of 31st of March, but in the comments we're making, we'll make comments, so the verbal comments will actually put it into the current stuff, because the act is obviously what only became effective on the 1st of June. So the real development has actually been since the date of the annual report. So that's the way that we try to put the two together. The first slide is just dealing with the board of directors. You'll see the board members there. Just 3 points to make is that the designated members, meaning that the departments of social development, of finance, of housing, and obviously trade and industry, each of those ministers has the right to appoint a member to the board to make sure that there's coordination between these departments, given that there is impact on all of them. You'll see the other board members there, and I think it is worth just noting that there's a broad range of expertise in the board. Ms. Radink was in development finance. She's been in development finance for many, many years. Ms. Glover is a housing finance specialist. Mr. Van Kalkweg is the credit information ombud. Mr. Storr is probably one of the foremost regulatory experts in the country. So we've got a very broad range of expertise on the board. The committees you see there, the remuneration committee, the policy and strategy committee, and the audit and risk committee, they're all fully functional. There's been various board meetings and a whole number of committee meetings already. So the board and governance stuff are all in place, but it's fully functional.
Let us welcome Ms. Radin, member of the board. It's not usual that members of the board attend meetings together with institutions. Some do, and we always appreciate that members of the board must actually take interest to what Parliament is doing and the concerns. And the praise that will be there, that will be coming from members of Parliament, so that when you engage in the board process, you will take on board the issues that are actually always come from members of Parliament. Thank you very much for coming. If you feel like at any stage, together with your team, you want to raise issues, please indicate. That's very good.
The next slide just talks about the whole registration process. As at the 31st of March, there were 3,900 credit providers that had applied for registration and had been given a temporary registration. The process is they first get a temporary registration and it gives us time to confirm and verify and review all the documentation before final registration. But even when they temporarily registered, they can still continue operating. It doesn't affect on their business. 8 credit bureaus were already fully registered by March. 51 debt counselors had submitted applications, but the debt counseling provisions, the debt counselors only assumed their functions from the 1st of June. So they weren't all required to be registered there, and I've got another slide on it as well. The right-hand block there, you will see the profile of the registrants as they had applied for registration, where you'll see the top categories. I mean, there's 6 credit providers that are more than 15 billion rand each, 15 billion rand. So those would be the banks primarily. And so they go down, and the bottom category, 3,300 credit providers, are each that sign should be smaller than each. Are each smaller than a million rand. So it is the fairly typical position where, I mean, in these, the numbers come out that 1% of the credit providers, about 130 institutions,
provides 99% of the credit. Those are the big institutions, the banks, the retailers, and so forth. The 99% of the institutions, all those small institutions, actually provide only 1% of the credit. So just to update this on where we are now at the end of September is that 848 registrations are finished. It constitutes 89% of all the applications. So the registration process is well on track. 89% of the volume of the industry is fully registered. The ones that is now outstanding and that is still processing are primarily that small category, and where you find that a lot of documentation are outstanding, and it's a big battle to get them all these the slower goes that keep the trial as well. But we are making good progress, so there's no major concern there. In terms of consumer education and awareness, the first strategic challenge that we faced at the NCR was how to approach the education and awareness campaign. Peter can possibly talk a little bit in the question time more on that, but the decision we took is that it would not make sense to make consumers aware of rights that they have prior to the effective date of the right. So if you tell consumers they can get a quote, but it is before 1 June, it's no use if they now go to the bank and say, give us a quote, and the bank tells them, but you can't get your quote because you're too early. The quote is only effective from 1 June. We therefore had to time our education activities around the effective date of the annual. So as of the date of the annual report and before 1 June, we focused on general awareness, so that people are aware that there is the act is coming, that there's some rights that will be protected. We also focus on credit bureau sections because they were already effective, and we specifically focus on the reckless credit and over-indebtedness, given that there was such a huge growth in credit. After 1 June, the focus is changing, where we're now going into much more specific issues. The bottom block there in the slide you'll see, as well as slide 4, are the types of activities that we've been conducting. Consumer education workshops, 128 of them, workshops with industry, 185 articles, 170 radio, TV adverts. If you look at the more recent stats, it is a lot higher even now. By this time, we've done 365 workshops. We had 273 radio interviews with various staff members. So we're quite happy from our perspective, although we will get the parliamentary perspective for the question. But in terms of our educational material, if you take those brochures that is on this picture, those are translated in all 11 languages, so they're available in all 11 languages, in hard copy as well as from our website. We've also already produced a simplified version of the Act dedicated to consumers. Basically, the consumer rights as is per the Act, that is like a booklet, and that is has been translated in all 11 languages and is now ready for distribution. It's also worth pointing out that on our call center, we've had more than 100,000 calls already at the NCR call center since we started. On our website, Peter just pointed out to me that we have had more than 780,000 hits on our website for information. So I have no doubt that the majority of South Africans even don't yet know of their rights, because it takes time. But I think we probably pushed it as hard as we can at this early stage, but it does take time. And I mean, that would be really the target for the future, to make sure that we keep the awareness campaign carrying on. And then one point to make here as well is that over the period since 1 June 2006 last year, when the NCR was created, we spent a lot of our energy engaging with industry as well, because the Act has a big impact on industry. And we've had basically monthly workshops with the senior legal advisors of all the banks. We've had workshops with the Association of Direct Marketeers, with the retailers. We've had workshops, I think we must have had 10 workshops or more with lawyers in different parts of the country. I know we've been in Northern Province, three times Cape Town, Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Free State, KZN, every. So we spend a lot of energy not only on consumer education, but also engaging with industry, given that they have to comply, and engaging with the people like lawyers and accountants, because they are in the fine analysis, the people that advise them, and from which the credit providers will be advised on how to comply. The credit bureau and credit bureau information. 8 credit bureaus had been registered already by the end of March. 3 applications were rejected. 5 were still in the process. By that date already, 60,000 consumers had gotten a copy of their free credit reports. About 30, you see, just more than 30,000 consumers had gotten copies of the reports that we had each. These numbers, the latest number, or by June, that 60,000 had grown up to 100,000 free reports. The bottom bit there is about the Section 73 regulations. Those are those regulations that you will be reminded that it is the so-called data cleansing regulations, the limited amnesty that is referred to. Those regulations were published by 1 December, those were published by DPI. They define certain types of information that had to be removed. That is what I summarized in that block. And it's stuff like adverse information below 500 rand. Judgments, as long as the person doesn't have more than 2 judgments. Even up to 50,000 rand, the judgments could be removed if the consumer paid up the judgment. So there was a balance between the nature of the information and what the consumer had to do to get it removed. But those smaller amounts were removed automatically. The removal had to take place by 1 June, that is 1 June now, so it was after the date of the annual report, but it had happened. The regulations, the Section 73 regulations, also provided for the auditors to do an audit of the credit bureau and give us those reports by the end of August. Those audits now had to confirm that the data that had to be removed was actually removed. We have already received all those audit reports. We are now analyzing those audit reports to in order to determine whether it was properly implemented. Our general perception from the NCR is that their data cleansing exercise has been most useful, most successful. We've had virtually no negative feedback from industry. Industry is telling us that this does not negatively impact on their ability to do credit assessment. Apart from that, from consumer side, the feedback from the bureaus is that somewhere around 6 million consumers had benefited from the data cleansing. That doesn't mean that their record is now clean. It just means that some information was removed and that the record is better than it was before. The number, I don't know if I didn't write it down, but somewhere around 200,000 consumers have records that is actually clean after this exercise. Which means that the only negative things that were on their record were things like dormant accounts and small adverse listings. So it seems to us at least is that it has achieved its purpose by giving a benefit to consumer, address the problems with the data without having undermined the ability from the industry to do credit assessment. In terms of research and public information, the chairman, you must tell me to go slowly. Start taking the speed globally. In terms of research and public information, the Act and the regulations provide for a number of statistical returns that the industry must provide to us and which we must then analyze and publish in the public domain. That covers returns both from credit bureaus and from credit providers. However, those returns have not been for the credit providers, the returns are not yet due. So the first returns from credit providers we would only receive in November. So then we will start processing them. The first set of returns from credit bureaus we've already received. That is being processed and finalized, and we would hope by before the end of October that the first set of information from credit bureaus would be published. What is covered in this slide, though, is a specific research project that we undertook by Feasibility Consulting, a lady called Dr. Hawkins, on the side of the growth in the credit market, given that it was such a concern from last year, June onwards. Now, I just want to maybe here go a little bit slowly, just to, it has been in the public domain for a while, but I'm not sure whether anybody really, the numbers got to everybody, because they're quite significant. If you look at the table there, which summarizes the growth in credit from 2002 up to last year, September, it shows us that the total consumer credit in South Africa has grown by 391 billion rand. 391 billion. It is huge, huge growth. It has grown by 134% over the last 4 years. So the total value of consumer credit taken by South Africa has more than doubled in 4 years. This kind of growth must raise cause for concern. However, the vast majority of that growth is sitting in mortgages. Of that 390 billion growth, 270 billion was mortgages. So the real growth is actually mortgages rather than in credit cards, which has been so much in the public domain. So if there was a problem in our credit market, it would be related to mortgages. In our perception, there's no systemic problem. The mortgage growth is probably still picking up the old lost ground from the many years when mortgage values have actually grown negatively. So that is where the growth is. We don't believe that systemically there's necessarily a problem. However, it is worth pointing out that on credit cards, and I think it might be fairly obvious, is that often when there's over-indebtedness, the over-indebtedness comes from credit cards, because it's an instrument which is difficult to manage, and when the consumer starts being in a debt-stressed position, it is normally their credit card that they start using more and more and more. And when they find they are not able to juggle the ball anymore, it is the credit card where the problem really is first. So even though credit cards, I mean, if you look at the table, the second from the bottom, credit cards grew from 13 billion to 37 billion, so nearly tripled, so it grew a lot. At 37 billion, it's still a lot smaller than mortgages. Mortgages is 400 billion. But it is as a credit card, I think that we, even though it is a lot smaller, it is always an area that one has to watch carefully. I do want to put a positive perspective on this, because I think there is a very big positive perspective. The bottom left-hand bit of the slide is from the research that was done, and definitely our perception as well, is that there's been very important structural changes in the way that the South African credit market is operating. That banks, where they traditionally have had very high income thresholds, and they weren't willing to deal with people that were low income, they dropped those income thresholds. They are actually now engaging with people of much lower income levels than they traditionally done. They are also doing a lot of product developments for the lower income markets. So, now this is obviously a sword with two sides. On the one hand, it means that the consumer that in the old days could probably only get a microloan. And microloans, the average cost of microloans in South Africa was around 90%, 90. Now this consumer, rather than having to borrow at 90%, can get a credit card probably at 25 or 30, 20 odd percent. So it's a lot cheaper for the consumer. But there is the other side of the coin, is that the credit card is an instrument that can go wrong very easily. And when it goes wrong, the consumer will have the challenges on consumers. So there's a positive and a negative. Long term, for sure, it must be good for the credit market. It means that our credit market starts to operate in an integrated manner and serving the broad majority of South Africans as well. But we have to be very careful for the risks that come from it. The next slide after this one, I'll get to some of those risks. It is worth, this slide just deals with the impact of the Act on the court system and on the magistrates in particular. And it's worth reflecting that actually, with everything, despite everything that we as NCR have to do, the primary impact of this act, the primary benefit of this act, is actually going to be brought by the magistrates. Because it's the magistrate that deal with the case between the consumer on the one hand and the service provider on the other hand. Just to check there's 65,000 debt-related judgments per month in South Africa. This number, by the way, however high it may look, it used to be 85,000 per month a couple of years ago. So it's actually come down. But 65,000 transactions per month where the magistrate has interpreted the National Credit Act and applied to the case at hand. So it has always been a major challenge to make sure that the magistrates get capacitated to deal with the new legislation. And there we would really express our thanks and our congratulations to the Justice College, which sits under the Department of Justice. They are responsible for trained magistrates. And they have launched a fairly big training program from, I think, from December last year, where they developed the whole training manual and they provided specialized training. I believe that by June, 700 magistrates had already gone through this training. So they've done that, made a huge contribution in making sure that magistrates can deal with this event. This doesn't mean that there's not going to be a challenge, because the Act is, my copy of the Act out there, but the Act is quite a mouthful for anybody to interpret and apply. And in the final analysis, the magistrate will have to go through every little section, be familiar with that section. So it is going to be a process, and there's going to be teething problems, but I think those are expected when you deal with an Act that has got this effect. Now this is probably the most complicated or controversial or sensitive topic that I think raised here, the debt counseling stuff. Now I think I would like to take just a bit of time to go through that left-hand side of that block, which is one specific case of own indebtedness. Now just before, you should ask yourself now, is this a extreme case? When I asked Peter before the time now, how many people do you think are in this extreme case? His guess was 50,000 people, between 50,000 and 100,000. My guess was at least more than 10,000 people are extremely own indebted. So extremely that they cannot come out month by month. Now, let us go through this, which is a real case. If the person earns 8,400 rand, his commitments, monthly commitments, is the normal living commitments, is 7, his mother, his total monthly commitment is 17,000 rand. Nearly 3 times what he earns, he must pay every month. Obviously, there's family members that from time to time help him. And obviously what also happens is that one month he pays here, next month he pays there, another month he pays somewhere else. So the whole time juggling. He has two mortgage bonds at the total value of 776,000 rand. That's his liability, where he signed for, on which he must pay 7,900 rand per month. His income is only 8,400 rand. He's got legal finance of 182,000 rand, on which he must pay 2,800 rand. He's got 2 credit cards, on which he owes 13,000 rand. 6 reserve accounts, on which he owes 28,000 rand. He's got an investment insurance policy, four more clothing accounts, plus a cell phone. Now, bottom line is he cannot come out with his income. And to just reiterate the point I made before, we think that at least 10,000 people are in this position. It may be up to between 15,000 and 100,000 people. Our statistics tell us, the research we've done tell us that there's more than 300,000 people in China that are so over-indebted that they will not be able to solve the problem by themselves. They will need some external assistance. Now, as if that, I'm not scaremongering, but as if that's not bad enough, there's probably 1 million more people that are what we would call debt-stressed. They can solve the problem if they start to use this money. So it is a big problem. Now, this is another point to make in relation, is that if one takes this case that we have on the slide here, the reality is, for this consumer to be restructured, you would have to negotiate with all these credit providers to get them to write off some debts. You have to negotiate with the consumer to get the consumer to start living within these. And you've got to do all of this in a manner that all these parties can actually accept. Because get to the take on this consumer. To solve this consumer problem means that this consumer is going to have to come out with a lot less money in the future. He's probably going to have to sell a car. He's probably going to have to sell one of his houses. The point I'm trying to make is it is not easy to deal with a case like this. And it is really important to detect that the kind of person that we want as a debt counselor must deal with this kind of a complicated case. Now, we've known this for a long time, so from the NCR side, we have invested a huge amount of our resources in trying to get ready for takeout. The training manual has been developed last year already. We've got training aids. Eight training service providers, big institutions, including some of the universities, including Gamelin, that does training of debt counselors. So there's an accredited training course that's been running since January. We provide special support to debt counselors. We've also developed or acquired the rights for a debt counseling software, a computer program that we provide free of charge to debt counselors, which they can use. We've got an internet-based system by which the debt counselor can, where they must lock the cases so that those details can go back to the credit bureaus and credit providers. But the bottom line of all of this is that the effective implementation of the debt counseling sections of the Act will take a huge effort, and it's not going to be easy, and we are only at the beginning of that challenge, and it's going to take a huge amount of goodwill from a lot of different parties, credit providers for one. I mean, if you take the case there on the left-hand side, that person cannot be assisted if the bank doesn't want to help, because the bank has given them two mortgages and two legal funds. Two cards in finance and the credit card as well. So the banks would have to cooperate, the consumer would have to cooperate, the magistrates would have to cooperate, so there's a whole lot of parties that would work together. Now, the biggest single problem that we're facing currently is the fact that the Act as it stands now regulates only the application fee for a debt counselor where the regulation determines that at 50 Rand. Now, at 50 Rand, if you imagine the kind of work the debt counselor must do to sort this mess out, it can't be done. The debt counselor that has to do this work and has to be only at 50 Rand will simply say, I'll go to something else. You need here people that can recover the cost. What we have done, given that the Act only regulates the 50 Rand and that the Act does not regulate the rest and that there's a potential for abuse there, what we have, the NCR has done, is the board has approved 5 million Rand from the NCR funding that we had from the old MMRC, from which we create a fund where we will pay the cost of debt counseling for low-income consumers earning less than 2,500 a month. At the same time, we are negotiating with an association of debt counselors that we can come up with some guidelines that will, given that the Act doesn't regulate those fees, that the guidelines will set some parameters to make sure that there's not abuse of consumers, because they are only debt counselors. But it is worth noting, though, that the fees that the consumer must pay, what the Act does determine is the debt counselor can't ask the fees up front. The debt counselor must take the case and will get the fees from the person that was restructured. So they will get the fees from the point after the person was restructured, so that the consumer is not prevented from going into debt counselor. So the fee issue is a big issue, but we've got some plans to try to address it. The other issue, positive issue to raise here, is that the credit providers, that's between the banks, retailers, microlenders, all of them together, have spent quite a lot of effort and time in terms of creating a voluntary system for assisting consumers that are debt stressed. Because the reality is, obviously, these people, the person that's only debt is a client of a bank or client of a retailer. And the first responsibility lying with a bank or retailer to assist that consumer. So they've invested quite heavily in there, and we are fully supportive of it, because we think the best answer is if the consumer is getting a system and solve the problem prior to even becoming aware of it. Good. I'm nearly finished. On the finance, on our finances, the top block there is the summary from the income statement, the bottom block is the summary from the balance sheet. We had 39 million rand of income and 38 of expenditure, the net of 141,000. The 83% of our income for this year up to March came from the DTI transfer, but the biggest reason is that the registration fees that we've received are a big chunk thereof are for people that haven't been, the registrations were not yet finalized. So those income will only go to the income statement when the registrations are finalized. We've received about 17 million rand in registration fees, but a lot of that is still lying in the bank and not yet allocated income. So in the future, we would expect that the government contribution to our expenses and the industry contribution should be the same, very close to 50-50. We got an unqualified audit opinion, so we were quite proud of that. There were some issues raised at emphasis of matter, which means it's issues which the auditors say that we need to give attention to. One of them are internal control, but it's primarily related to the fact that as the NCR got established, we started off with the systems and procedures of the old NFRC. So these need to be now upgraded for the new demands. The other two issues were minor issues about for the season. We can go through these questions if you need to. The human resources, the next slide, is, I mean, there's a picture of the NCR, and it must be about 90% of us, is the, you'll see that our 51 permanent employees as at the end of March. We are now up to, I think, about 65. We still have about 40 vacancies. 56% of our staff are female, 82% of the staff are Black South Africans. 30% of the management team female, 60% of the management team is Black South Africans. The last slide is to take stock, of after the date of the annual report, between the date of the annual report and now. First bullet point, they just are talking about those credit bureau regulations. I think I've covered it in the slide already, so I'm going to skip that. Head counseling, I think I've covered fairly extensively as well. But just maybe to summarize that, there's a couple of things that are critical areas in the head counseling. One of the big issues is the fee issue that must be resolved, and then there must be more. In the final analysis, we believe that there will have to be regulations. There will have to be regulations that regulate more extensively, but that allow sufficient income for the debt counsel to enable the debt counsel to get the job done. The other issue, obviously one of the big ones, is that the person that's only debtor is the magistrate's court in the final analysis that will have to hear that case. The magistrates, for this, is a completely new thing for the magistrate. And you can imagine, if a magistrate is confronted with that case, as I demonstrated, and the bank is appointed senior counsel that opposed the application, it is not uncomplicated, so there is going to be some teething problems there, and we in some ways have to accept it. On the other hand, it is clear that we work on very hard in order to get them addressed. And it's nice also to be able to say that the Department of Justice cooperated very, very well with us in terms of, when we work together, in terms of coming up with a set of proposed regulations that will assist the magistrates also in dealing with these cases. The pre-agreement quotes, that's the third point there. As you are aware, that the language requirements of the Act are quite extensive. Requiring that credit providers must assist consumers in the language of their choice. The first step of that process is that it's a pre-agreement quote that is prescribed. In order to assist in that process, we at the NCR translated the pre-agreement quote in all 11 languages. It's on our website, it's been on our website since the beginning of June. And the credit provider can simply download it from the website and use it as it is. Alternatively, download it Word, convert it into their own format and use it. We are busy working on the whole language issue in a broader context, which is dealt with as a condition of registration. We can get to that in the question time. investigations and monitoring, that's the fourth point, is that I've not dealt with the presentation so much on investigation and monitoring, because actually by the 31st of March the Act was really effective. We were still dealing with the old UJ Act, the Agreements Act, and the Insurance. But I can just maybe point out here is that quite a number of investigations had been done in UJ Act, the Agreements Act, and the Insurance cases, somewhere close to 200. More importantly, maybe, is people may be aware of a case with a company called Rasco Finance, which had been collecting its loan repayments prior to doing loan disbursements. In that case, we have already issued a compliance notice, which is as provided for by the Act. We have been in negotiations with the same company, and we are at the point where we think that they will consent to the prescribed solution, which is that they must simply pay back the consumers the money that they've received illegally. And we are at the point of taking that case to the tribunal so that it can become a consent order. And if we can achieve that, and if they comply with that, then that will be a superb efficient intervention to deal not just with the non-compliance, but to make sure that the consumers actually get their money back. We've also done already, in the first big inspection we did was in Durban, is that we went there shop by shop, I think we covered about 19 outlets, to check whether they actually complying with the Act. Afterwards, right now, our investigators are walking around in Cape Town as well, focusing on the retailers in Cape Town, is looking to the manner that retailers have converted from the old UJ Act to the new National Credit Act, and the way that the retailers advertise. We have some evidence that some retailers simply put on their window, just give us your ID number and you'll get credit. Now that's illegal. So we want to deal with those things, and we want to deal with those decisively. Now, these retailers are big companies. Many of them are listed. But as from where we come in is that if you're big and listed, it doesn't mean that you can't comply with that. You still have to comply with it. In fact, you should particularly comply with that because you've got the risk of consumer dislike. So we are dealing with that. Currently, it's not easy, obviously, because these are the big boys with big budgets, so we have to do it very, very properly. And then last but not least, is I think many people would have had seen the comments in the newspapers about how this new National Credit Act brought the whole credit industry to a standstill. Now, I just want to make a couple of comments on it, is that it's worth noting that Mr. Manuel and Mr. Boweni has had a strategy for at least the last 2 years of reducing credit by increasing the interest rates. All the statistics that we've seen say that the credit extensions have already started reducing even before our Act. So I think they're giving us more credit than what we really knew in this matter. Although, obviously, if somebody argues, if the motor vehicle traders particularly are complaining a lot, if they say that they can't give credit to consumers over 11, then we just ask ourselves now, why should they have ever given credit to consumers over 11? Because it cannot be for the benefit of the consumer. And the long and short of it as well is that if one reflects on what has happened in the United States recently, where due to over indebtedness of people that is poor, where those same people who are poor lost their houses, it now had a huge impact on the banking system and a huge impact on the international financial system. We have always been worried about the potential of, we know about the financial sector charter, and it is obviously something that we need, something like a financial sector charter to get banks to change their direction. However, while we've also always been very nervous, of saying, what if the banks, in order to achieve their objectives in the charter, now start doing loans that make people over-indebted? So, from where we stand, we're saying that the Act is creating that balance. It tells the financial sector charter pushing the banks to do more lending at the low income market. And what our Act is doing is to say, but then you cannot go and be reckless in the way that you lend. Because if you reflect on this 300,000 people that is overdebted in South Africa, it is not a reckless borrowing, but it is also reckless lending. Both of these things must be regulated together. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Devon. I just want to
why we are bringing 10 questions around for the room.
Thank you. Mr. Dabo, in your submission, I think I couldn't agree more. I think reckless borrowing and reckless lending points to a serious threat to, you know, to our economic well-being in this country. The figure that you mentioned there of something up to 100,000 people that find themselves in this particular predicament, which is mentioned on page 3, for practical purposes, this person or this individual is bankrupt. I cannot see how you'll be able to recover. What I want to ask you is, shouldn't we introduce legislation which will force irresponsible lenders not to provide credit to people which poses a high risk? Because, I mean, how a person of this, which is in this particular financial status, says how he could obtain credit is beyond me. I mean, if you look at his mortgages, you look at his personal sort of his insurance and so forth, it amazes me how he managed to stay afloat. I'd like to have some views on that as well, and I think we should take proactive steps to stop people to provide credit to individuals which should in such a predicament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I still want to ask about your human resources. You have 8 contract employees and 10 vacancies. I would like to ask that those 10 vacancies is most of at which level, and how you dealing with when you have these vacancies, you know, how you dealing with the job, the job there. And you have 8 contract employees, and most of them in which level of these eight contract employees. Because previous one, you know, when that SABS, they have presentation, they say from the level 5 to 1, it's under contract for 3 years. I do not know whether that is then to yours, alright? Because to me, if you have the contract people from 3 years, this guy is not going to perform at all. Because we all know the first year, second year is almost like a learning period, no? And the third year, you know, that he's starting to panic to see where I'm going to go. And you know, they say if you're using a proper contract, you know, you have structure, it means maybe we can prevent these cases. But at the moment, we didn't see it, you know. And you know, how you're dealing with all these things, your human resources, you know, to make the people to feel comfortable. Because if you have the bad, the really bad in the business, even in the organization, or your delivery service is the worst one is to no decision, you know, to make no decision is the worst decision you make. But you know, when you make decisions, you will make some mistakes. And I believe Pula is through the agency to get these funding out is only to protect themselves. So if I make mistakes, right, to give to any, if I don't make any mistakes if I work for Pula. If anything, the money is not going back, the agents have a responsibility because everybody's scared. If they make one mistake, they might lose the contract. You know, and I don't know, you know, this is, you know, if every, you know, you are calling to the whole country, the same, the law or not, you know, but I personally believe all the service delivery, you have to look very carefully about this contract for 3 years one. Okay.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, I'm glad to. My questions are on the following. National Credit Regulator. You talked about monitoring of the conduct of the credit provider. To what extent are you doing this based on the fact that there is a lot of people in a credit bureau? What mechanisms are there in place to help these people? Why are you slowly in dealing with this matter? Then the other area is educational awareness. How far have you gone? Because seemingly you are just just silent on both urban and rural areas? Why are you so silent on all of those areas? Last, just the counseling. How many people have you counseled in urban and rural areas? Because it's where poverty is high and there is a possibility of indebtedness. Those areas, you know, has lots of illiteracy and poverty, and its indebtedness could be also extreme high. What are you doing in those areas? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, I don't know if this case that you present is a real case or a fictitious case. You see, one of the arguments we had, problems we had when we were passing this legislation, was that there's sort of certain, shall I say, punishments for reckless lending, which is fine, it's acceptable. But when you're a reckless borrower or an irresponsible borrower, then what? You then get counseled. Now, where does the debt counseling go in? Will it go in to find out, maybe this guy lied to all these credit providers? Would that then eliminate reckless lending? Is this a result of what the concern was of clearing credit bureaus, because now they have no credit record of this Mr. X? So how are we going to deal in practice with this type of situation? Because if the lenders didn't know, they're not reckless, I assume. And if the guy lied, and he's now obtained credit under false pretenses, are we now going to try and counsel him to protect him at the expense of the lenders? I'd like your comment, you know, on how we resolve this practical situation, which hits a lot of people. And then when they refuse, if they refuse credit to this chap, then he would be accused of, you know, withholding credit from you know, people. And the other thing is, I'm very interested. I think the growth of mortgages. I was trying to work out percentages on, you know, on your information and the research and public information. I think it looks like the mortgage growth has grown 155%. I haven't got calculating the other growth, so I can't see the percentages. And I think mortgage growth, I think, is a very healthy symptom of our society, because it means people are buying and purchasing homes. And there's this, you know, like Mr. X has got two mortgages. But where is the if you look at the mortgage, you know, this little table on the research and public information, where are the, shall we put it, you know, the red lights or the yellow lights flickering in terms of installment sales, leases, overdrafts, and credit cards? You know, is there certain areas where, you know, the term is often, you know, the yellow lights are flickering before they turn red? And then what can be done in such cases? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abakaki. The fictitious cases and the real cases. Well, cases have gone before courts and judges have done this good judge, whether this was fictitious or is a real case, somebody killed him. Now, in this instance, the NPR and ourselves had to judge whether this is the act is over-indebted
or not, and what must be done. Thanks for the questions. Go ahead, sister.
Thank you, Chair. I must say, well, one is welcome to the just common point, not only on behalf of it, that the NCR has ultimately come back. It was a very, very enriching experience when we went through the act. Obviously, the CEO and his colleagues can attest to that. Chair, I think also the sound system here is not as quality as it used to be, but obviously I'll try my best. Chair, I have a couple of questions, but obviously I felt that it's appropriate to comment because we've been on our own monitoring the implementation of the Act one way or another. In fact, one of the things I wanted to comment about is that one has observed is some level of concern, the attempt confusing reports or comments from credit providers through commercial media. On one newspaper, you'll get very negative stories, and on the other one, you get a different set of indications on the impact of the Act, to the extent that there were times when I would even make press clippings, just apologies that I didn't bring them, but it would be good just to get a comment on that. My questions are, given that it is said that 1% of credit, 99% of credit providers give only 1% of credit, what would be then the prognosis of the impact of the Act on that? Is there any likelihood that it would change it, change the balance, because 1% provides 99% and 99% provides 1%. And just another question that Emma just questioned. My interest would be the rural urban statistical analysis. Not that one would expect that he has, but that, what has been your sense, particularly in terms of the number of credit providers, those even debt counselors, you know, those based in the rural versus to urban areas. Chair, it is claimed that the largest amount of credit went into the mortgage. What implications would this have on the circulation of money? Because I assume, you know, what case you just buy, the money is sitting with the bank, if I'm correct. Excuse me, my naive understanding, whereas at least with other areas, there's a little bit of better circulation of money. With regards to the lending of market trade, one is curious just to know is that why not also train prosecutors, or are they not involved in this sector at all? The allocation of 5 million rand for the cost of debt counseling is highly commended. But one is also concerned that it's a little bit limited, the extent to which that can be sustainable definitely provokes the need to be quite innovative and creative to ensure that how do we look into that in the future. And therefore the question is, has there been any attempt to look into that? How do you finance it? Probably by financing it, it would trigger more interest, more demand would come, and maybe also on the other hand, have you tried to look at some international models to see how that thing handles? Chair, are there any prospects of turnaround because due to the impact of the Act, because the presentation makes reference to the reduction of the volume of credit and increased supply. Will there be any change somewhere on those two factors? The last share but not least as proposal. The issue of credit in South Africa is very, very important. The fact that the presentation alludes that there are about 300,000 people who are over indebted in South Africa ought to be a point of or a cause for concern to all of us as public representatives, not just a few that are here in the Portfolio Committee for Trade and Business. And I direct this proposal to you, Chair, that it might be helpful to just explore that maybe down the line the National Credit Regulator runs a general seminar or does some voluntary presentation to as many parliamentarians as possible. For public representatives, our work is to do our best to ensure that we contribute to the transformation of this country, and amongst others, is to assist and do whatever to create a better credit environment for the country. The other proposal is to ensure that there must be a structured way for sharing information. This is a new area. We know, particularly with other agencies, particularly Kula, that because they were very creative and they were quite frequent at the initial stages, we were able to get offer in whatever they were doing and give the requisite support. I say that because I regard this area as a very, very important one. You know, we work with poor communities, we work with people who are affected by credit. We therefore understand why it's so important that as public representatives, that as parliamentarians, we should be constantly, you know, updated with information on trends taken regarding the good work that the National Credit Regulator is doing. Obviously, Chair, I'm saying that as a way of proposing a creative way of sharing information, we cannot expect the team to be coming to Cape Town time and again, but obviously there could be other creative ways of sharing information. I thank you.
Sharing information with parliamentarians as a whole, public representatives in general. Yeah, I think that's a good question. I saw Mr. Stowe actually sharing this information with Joint Cocker in the Northwest. Maybe that was one of the first and the last team of public representatives. So they are going to talk to that. Just two questions from me as well. The monitoring of the credit providers with regard to the agreement that Adam is signed by them and the people that follow. How far have we inspected this agreement? Sometimes we are told about the findings that are there, and we have said time and again that those findings should be highlighted in the agreement. Eli Goldman in the range and properly explained to individuals. Well, with the fact of public education, consumer education, is there a work plan that is in place? Because I gather that you have indicated that we do not want to rush, because the act would not be effective then when there would be raising issues with credit providers. So, until June this year. Now,
stated that the bill is planned, you know, putting up plans to the fact that we are going to be tired.
Peter to kick off. I don't know if I can kick off because quite a few things deal with education and awareness and the rural urban that is really his area of expertise.
Thank you, Chaplain. On the question of consumer education, we have dedicated staff members whose function is really to do consumer education. We have covered indicated earlier on that we've had, to date we've had in excess of 305 workshops with NGOs, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, also then target trade unions, but employer-focused sort of communication, and most importantly, as most of you know, that consumer protection is a concurrent area of competence for both the provincial and the national sphere of government. We tend to work very, very closely with all the 9 provincial consumer desks who have got the ways and means of actually accessing various areas located within their province. As a result of this special relationship that we have with provincial consumer desks, we've often been able to reach out to rural areas and semi-urban areas as well. Most importantly, radio has proven to be one of the effective tools, in particular in creating awareness for people who are living in the rural areas. That is why you realize that we tend to do a lot of radio programs, not only national radio stations, we also tend to also focus on community-based radio stations, particularly those communities where such community-based radio stations. We have also been working with some of the traditional authorities. Obviously, this represents work in progress, but we do have dedicated NCR staff members whose function is really to focus on this. We have also started, actually had quite a number of workshops that we've been co-hosting with constituency offices, various constituency offices. So we hope that in this manner, we will be able to reach out to quite a substantial number of people, both in the rural areas and in the urban areas. And by the way, consumer education is a process. We believe that it's a process. And hopefully at some point, we might need to really, maybe in the next season, we might need to dissect so that we can really demonstrate how has it happened, particularly in the rural areas, to what extent has it covered that part, the rural areas in particular. Debt cancelling, there were other questions raised on debt cancelling, particularly in the rural areas. Debt cancelling represents one of the biggest challenges that we have as the NCR in implementing the National Credit Act. It's a new intervention. Gabriel did raise the whole issue around the fees, and our belief is that to some extent, partly the reason why we've not seen debt cancellers actually coming in larger numbers is primarily one of the issues was the fee issue. However, from our statistics, certainly we've seen some of the debt cancellers, for example, operating in some of the we started seeing some of the debt cancellers coming on board, registering with us, some of whom come from the rural area. I know of one specific area where the chief in that specific area is also a debt cancellor. So I thought that's very significant. Gabriel, maybe I'll let me pass this to you, then if there are anything that you haven't covered, I'll finish. Through you, Chair.
To go start from the top, so we'll skip the one this year. The question about this case being, the consumer being bankrupt, I think that is the reality. The part of the problem in South Africa currently is that we don't have personal bankruptcy legislation in place. But I believe it is an area that is part of the Department of Justice's, projects to get the whole new legislation on commercial and personal bankruptcy, because that's the direct part of it. That's the real answer in the long run, even that is a partial answer to it, because it is an open case, it is a bankruptcy, it is very similar to a bankruptcy case. The rules that we have in the National Credit Act, though, goes quite a long way. So the one thing, specifically, there's one part of the question, is that after 1 June, if a credit provider gives a loan to a consumer, which is already, where the consumer is already overindebted, if this consumer then defaults, and the credit provider goes to the court to go and get the judgment, the judge will have to ask, the credit provider will have to demonstrate to the judge that the person to the magistrate, that the person who defaults the credit, otherwise they will not get a judgment. Otherwise the magistrate has the right, per our act, to throw this case out of court, to call the debt reckless, and then to have to suspend the repayments altogether. So there's a big penalty both in our act to prevent new increased indebtedness. The problem, obviously, the facts that we have here, that was a real case. Okay, Mr. X is a real Mr. X, and it is not the worst, by the way, is that the record we have now, that I'm aware of, is somebody whose monthly payment is 5 times the monthly income. This was 3 times, or 2.5 times. So, it is a very real case. The problem that we're sitting with, these are obviously debts that have been built up over before the Act was here. So we're sitting with the current debt up before the Act. However, debt counsellors have the ability to deal with debts both of old debts and of new debts. So they can restructure the whole loan and go with a proposal to the court, and the court, if the court approves that proposal, it becomes a court order that will change the repayment, the claims on the repayments of the credit provider. So if you take in the case of the mortgage, if the court order determines that the consumer in the future is only going to get paid, the credit provider, the bank, can only get half the repayment, and is approved by the court order, the bank will have no legal claim on anything more, and you would not be able to take that house back either. So there is a mechanism to intervene, and what the mechanism really does, I mean, I'm making it sound too confrontational, it's not unfair, because that bank should have to take it out. But in the cases that get resolved, the banks look at this as well and say, I'm never going to get the money back. I'm having a write-off here, that is for sure. Even before our act, he would have had a write-off, because that doesn't come from me. So at least now the bank gets to the point to say, but what is realistically expected here? They negotiate with the debt counsellor, and the debt counsellor really does the negotiation, and then come up with a payment plan, and then after the bank would have done the write-off as well, in order to get to a state. So it is like an indirect insolvency mechanism, but the cases like these are very, very difficult to resolve. That's not, I mean, it's true. On the case about the contract employees, the contract employees that we have are two categories. The most of them are people at a fairly entry level, so it would be like data capturers or administrative staff in the registration division, where the reality is that we're sitting with a huge volume of applications right now, applications that we may, once we process them, we won't need that many people in that kind of function. So we're pulling those people to deal with the initial volumes until the things can settle down. And then the contract is not long-term contract, I think. It's typically 6 months for my colleague. The other category of contract employees are people that come from the professional firms like KPMG or Private Hotels or Deloitte or the lead law firm. So we've got, four people that are professionals, lawyers or accountants that we get in also right now, because we now have such extreme volumes.
to assist us in dealing with this implementation phase. They are, so it's not these contact individuals that are basically reporting to contact to us, where we pay a fee for, again, it's like 6 months, 9 months, I think is the longest, where once we've created sufficient internal capacity, we won't need those contact positions anymore.
Sorry, can I just say, so the 3 to 5 year contract you don't consider
is considered? We don't think we've got anybody with 3 to 5 year contracts. The longest that I'm with.
The longest that he has is a year.
So each credit bureau has had an external auditor that checked what they're doing. We've got those reports. We're now working through them to take further action. The other side of it is that what the Act determined is that even if the consumer did nothing, the consumer didn't have to do anything to get that data removed. The Act determined that the data had to be removed. So that 6 million consumers that benefited, they got that benefit without having to do anything. It was the Act that determined, the credit bureaus had to remove the data and order the same check that is getting removed. The other side of the picture is that there where a consumer, the other side of the picture is really dependent on the consumer getting their free record, checking the report and complaining. And I mean, and as I indicated, there's about 100,000 people that got free reports already. Another, I think, 30,000-40,000 that paid 20 rand per report. So it is, I guess the last answer is a very far bit of the thing. It is also dependent on the awareness campaign. Maybe when Peter knows more, but there was a big campaign introduced that included even television ads to make consumers aware of how they can get their delivery directly. Maybe I'll pass that for Peter to comment on when I'm done. So in terms back to the over-indebted case, Mr. Labuschagne's question is, though the case is very real, we have many of these on record. The consumer, we totally agree, the consumer was irresponsible as well. You don't get that over-indebted by the TTS. But the penalty on the consumer is huge as well. Firstly, is that consumer, until he repays all the debts, cannot borrow again anymore. So he's now prohibited by law from borrowing until he's repaid all his debts and is getting declared not to be owed indebted anymore. If the consumer lies, then the credit provider, as Mr. Lamaschak indicated, can't be declared records. That doesn't mean he can't be rescheduled, but he can't be declared records. And if you take this kind of case, that consumer's income is 8,000 rand, his commitment is 17,000 rand. What is happening in his life currently, he's probably living at a 12,000 rand income level, even though his own income is only 12. So he's using credit to live beyond his means. Once he's restructured, he has only one choice. His income, his expenditure will be have to reduce dramatically. And in fact, our estimate is, once a consumer has gone through debt restructuring, he will probably have to come out on 20, 30, 40% less than what he came out with before the debt restructuring. So the penalty on a consumer of having gone into debt restructuring is huge. Debt restructuring is not an escape for a consumer. All it is a mechanism to create a legal formula through which to resolve the problem. So, but for consumers, it is not the case. In fact, what we already find is a number of consumers approach the debt counselor, they have the first few discussions, and then they actually run away again. Because they don't like the fact that the penalty that it has on them, and also the fact that once the debts are restructured, it becomes a court order. So he will now have to comply by law to the restructuring. One more comment though is what I fully expect is that a good percentage of these cases that is restructured may end up defaulting until the thing settles down, because the consumers have a perception, so many consumers have a perception that this is a way to run away from your debts. And But it is, I mean, I know a number of cases, including a very good debt counselor that we have in Cape Town, that once the consumer starts playing games, the debt counselor typically tells them, good, you're not going to deal with me anymore. Now you're going to sort out your own problems. The indication then is the credit provider can go back to the courts and go and get a judgment. Because that consumer had a mechanism to solve, to address the problem, and he doesn't want to take the benefit of it. Then he must simply get to the court and face the credit providers in the court. In terms of the feedback from the credit providers, we very much agree with the observation. It was very interesting at some point to notice that the one person in the bank would say how bad the act is, another person in the bank would say how good the act is. But in the final analysis, I think the reality has been people like motor vehicle financiers were affected quite heavily. And it was affected because many motor vehicle financiers had been giving loans, giving credit, beyond what people could afford, because they worked on the assumption that the person, if the person defaults, they will sell the car. Now what happens in reality is the person is so afraid of losing the car that they pay the motor vehicle and they default on the house. I mean, we've seen that in reality. So, but the general feedback that we have from the banking sector is actually very positive. I mean, we get increasing and more feedback from the banking sector that, and it's also part of this fallout in America, that people are saying that this is the kind of regulations we want to make sure that that there's a balance between credit granting and the level of indebtedness. The magistrates versus prosecutors, though, the cases that we're talking about here in the magistrates' courts, they are mostly civil litigation. So it will be a lawyer on behalf of the consumer approaching against a lawyer on behalf of the credit provider. So the state prosecution is generally not involved. So it's got a lot less impact on prosecutors. We agree with the comment that, I mean, the 5 million rand will only cover about 5,000 cases that we can cover from the fund that we created. DTI has made a commitment that they will contribute further money. So they are going through the PMMA process of allocating that money, and we are applying from other sources as well. But it's also true in the long term, the consumers would have to contribute to this cost as well. And it would be done by the consumer contributing to the restructured repayment. So that is probably the long term solution. What we're dealing with now is implementation arrangements. The one comment again, let us put things in perspective. If we say our estimate is more than 300,000 people are extremely over-indebted, the extreme means it's hospital cases. Another million is over-indebted, but they can probably with some aspirin or what, with self-discipline they can solve the problem. But let's reflect that there's 16 million people with debt. 16. So it is not in perspective, it is about, we talk about less than 10%, probably around 5% of people there. So the majority of consumers are getting benefit from the credit. It is a minority, as always, that where the things go wrong. So we must be careful for not seeing this as at all values. And then the last one on the monitoring of the agreements and of the, and how to make sure the banks comply. Just two comments. On the one hand, what the National Credit Act does is, what the National Credit Act does, it prescribes certain types of contractual clauses that they're not allowed to have in their hands at all. If they take legal action and it goes in front of the magistrate will simply cut those things out. He will simply disregard those clauses that are unlawful. On the other side is that these things do get pointed to the, they don't get to us directly, but they get pointed to the banking office. And we have a lot of engagement with the banking office as well, which then does the same. When he do a hearing, he disregard all those illegal, so there's no use for a bank to have an illegal clause. But the last, and maybe for me the most important one, is that what the Act does, it says that, I mean, this is 11 one-page, it's a one-page summary of the whole credit agreement. The credit provider is forced now to put all the, what they call key clauses in a one-page summary, so to which the consumer can hopefully now understand and don't have to read the 20 page to find the that goes with it. It's very similar to the mechanism that they have in the US as well. So this, I think, is probably the biggest mechanism that's going to prevent the fine print from having such a huge impact in the credit market. There's a couple of
can we have that in the copy of that feature, that number?
Only two things from my side, Chief. One is on awareness campaigns that we usually run around and the Amnesty issue. Every year we've probably done a lot more. I mean, we have been running a radio advertising campaign for over three to four months just on the Amnesty, explaining to people what credit bureau regulation is all about, what rights do they have in terms of the new dispensation and so on. Also informing them that they've got a right to one free record. We've also joined the credit information in a campaign that was also set to remind consumers about the pending deadline. And this was a campaign worth about 4 billion rand. Multiform, through radio, through TV, through print media as well. So we've actually been doing a lot of awareness creation around all these issues. There was an important point that was raised on other court officials that we probably need to look into. And for me, the group that stands out is the clerks of the court, because these are the people who tend to be involved in the whole process. And it's something that we also had some preliminary discussion with the Justice College on, and certainly something that we will be taking forward, because we believe that if we can invest on ensuring that clerks of the court are also trained, then things become a lot more.
Thank you. Can you deal with the public with them?
On the issue of public representatives, we continue to engage with public representatives at provincial and at local level. Certainly there is happening, there's a lot happening, but it's a process, as I said. So we wait on that change.
At that note, we want to thank the MDI, the CEO and the team, and wish you well on the march of the debt counseling fee, funding, and other initiatives. Was we ourselves have actually came across this outcry from the some of the debt counselors claiming that the fee structure is inhibited in terms of them actually succeeding to do the work. So wish you well there. And we'll keep on interacting with you from time to time. This is not a one-off and one done. I wish to thank you very much and to say to everyone that today, unfortunately, there's no free lunch. Grab that time.
Okay, so we get the business card.
Thank you very much. I know you don't have to. You only write those who ask questions. That's all they are.
Sorry.
I don't know how to use that. So you didn't work on your question. You said that if you just do one part, so they can do it.